right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show, we're going to examine one of the great crimes of our times, the incarceration of poor Black and Latino people in the chambers of horror that make up the American system of prisons and jails. What happens behind prison walls, who's sent there, the treatment they receive, all of this is a horror. It's a horror carried out behind closed doors by a system that tells us over and over again that it represents freedom, that it's the leader of the free world. At the back end of the show, I'm going to replay an interview I did with Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Now, I spoke with Michelle Alexander shortly after the book's release. It has now become one of the most influential works in recent years, and the expression The New Jim Crow has passed into the way we talk about this. And opening the show up is someone I've really wanted to talk to for a while. Ever since I read a book that is just as important in its own way to understanding the nature of the crime of mass incarceration. The book is by Mary Boozer. It's called Lockdown on Rikers. It's shocking stories of abuse and injustice at New York's notorious jail. And I have to tell you, folks, I read this book and my mind was blown. It was a very heavy book. It was very, very heavy, very, very moving. Stuff you don't even think about. And this is, I'm somebody who's paid a lot of attention to this, to the situation with prisons, with imprisonment, with police terror. And I read this book and I was just, it was riveting. I was just couldn't stop reading the book. I read it all the way through in one sitting and I could not stop. And I think it's really, really important that people understand what the hell is going on in this world right now. Mary, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you.
How do you say your last name, Mary?
It's not that hard. Buser.
Buser. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Yes,
I've gotten all kinds of different alphabets up there. Buser. Okay. Okay. Buser. All right. And Mary Buser is the author of Lockdown on Rikers, Shocking Stories of Abuse and Injustice at New York's Notorious Jail. And it's a personal account of everything that's going on there, the tortures, the beatings, the abuse and mistreatment in one of the country's largest lockups. Mary, I'm really pleased to have you on the show today because I think your work is really, really important for people to get. So, Mary, let's just jump right into the interview with you.
Okay.
For people who don't know, I want to know, well, first off, what made you write this book and what brought you there? You know, for people who don't know what Rikers Island is as well, explain it and then tell us what brought you there, working there, but also what made you write the book?
Well, what brought me there was actually an internship. I was getting my master's degree in social work, and I was assigned to work on Rikers Island. I really didn't know too much about it. What I will say is just give you a brief overview. Rikers is a 400-acre complex island in the northern region of New York City's East River. It is a complex of jails. It's not a prison complex, but jails, which is a very important distinction because jails are for people who have been charged with a crime, but they have not been convicted, and as such, they are presumed innocent. The reason they are held on Rikers Island is because they do not have money, in most cases, for bail. So if you can pay bail, you go home while you wait for the resolution of your case. If you can't, you go to Rikers Island. 10 Rikers jails, one for women, 9 for men. When I was there, 20,000 people on Rikers. A standard prison is usually 1,800 to 2,000 people. So at over 20,000, it gives you an idea of the scope of Rikers. So that little brief aside, I went. I was actually excited about it. I was not worried about working with accused criminals. I believed in the dignity of all human life and the capacity for people to change, and I kind of relished it. And I went in there and worked with these women who, as you can predict, are poor, disenfranchised, uneducated, minorities. And I really thought this was it for me. I loved the work. I bonded easily with the women, and I saw potential for really helping people. Once I got my master's, I came right back to Rikers, and then things started changing. I became much more aware. When I came back, I was assigned to work with men. And then I became much more aware of brutality, of the unfairness of the bail issue, and the role it plays in people accepting guilty pleas, even if they're not guilty, and how they're forever relegated to a fringe-type existence in society because of the felony. Tremendous bias against the poor. I felt very frustrated by the brutality around me and my inability to do much about it. I was then promoted to an assistant chief of mental health, where I wound up as acting chief in the 500-cell solitary confinement unit. And when I got to see up close just what solitary confinement is about, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the levels of suffering that it induces, and I couldn't believe my role in it. And when I began to realize that I was no longer the idealistic intern I'd once been, but I was at this point really a cog in a wheel here of something that I knew was wrong. And, you know, you have all the earmarks of everything being right, the flag, uniforms, doctors, et cetera. But ultimately, I had to leave Rikers. And when I did, however, I could not forget. And I thought, what can I do? What can I do? And I thought, I couldn't do much from within, but now from without, I thought, people need to know. People don't understand what our judicial system is really about, what our prisons, you know, people have this idea that everyone is treated humanely, and it's all false. And I had to try to find a way to communicate this, and I couldn't sleep at night until I knew I was doing something, and that's why I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's what drove me. Couldn't forget.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I want to explore some of these things, because one of the things that really struck me, and it's early on in the book, where you talk about your first assignment, and I guess it was when you were doing the volunteer stuff, your student stuff, and your first assignment was in the women's jail, and for the first time when you went there, you talk about when they opened this door, and there's just all these women in cages.
Yes.
And you said this was the shock of seeing human beings in cages like this. This really sort of hit you. And this is a theme you hit at a lot throughout the book, which is the way the system systematically dehumanizes everyone who's there.
Oh, yes. It's horrendous. And it was my first day and very eager. And we walk into what's called the receiving room, where the newly arrested are processed and then given housing assignments within the jail. And as you just said, bullpens, as they call them, packed with people, human beings, and it was a sight to behold, you know, waving their hands, crying, etc. And the guards stood in front counting them. Counting is a very big thing in jails and prisons, keeping count. And all they referred to these women as is bodies. 10 bodies in this cell, 20 bodies over here. And I was stunned that people could be referred to as bodies. And it also struck me, if these people had been able to afford bail, they would have been on the outside awaiting their trial, as opposed to dumped in here and automatically a body. And the other word was property. Once you're on Rikers, you are, quote, property of New York City. If you are sentenced and go upstate, then you are property, you become state property. There is this distancing. There is this way of trying to turn human beings into boxes, and it really, I think, legitimizes a lot of, in people's minds, brutality against inmates because they're not really people.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mary Buser and about her book, Lockdown on Rikers. Mary, one of the things when you're talking about this dehumanization, it really struck me, and I'm somebody who, as I said, has paid attention to this, and it really struck me, though, that when you mentioned Rikers is a jails complex and not a prison, you know, and you say this thing, it's very important to make that distinction. And it's basically, you argue in the book that this is a concentration of the reality of what it means to be poor and an oppressed nationality in relation to the law in this country today. And I'd like you to explore that a little bit, tell people some examples, explore a little bit, because that was very, very heavy. A lot of people don't understand that. You know, it's like they can say, well, we just, you know, yeah, you know, black and brown people end up in prison disproportionately. Yes, that's true. But there's actually, when you have a prison like Rikers that is a jail, it's not a prison. When you have, as you said, you have a jail, that means mm-hmm. that people are, you know, people go there because of their situation in life, you know, not because they have been convicted of anything. So let's talk about this, the reality of this, you know, the reality of what it means to be poor and how that's concentrated and what happens at Rikers.
Sure, sure. And this is so essential to everything because the number is 80 to 85% of the people. One qualifier is one of the buildings is for people who have been sentenced to a year or less, one of the 10. So that's technically a prison. Everything else there, the mainstay of the population is jail. Now, what that means is that everyone there has been charged with something, But it's not hard to be charged with something. The police can charge you with anything and arrest you and say, well, you know, sort it out, tell it to the judge, whatever. And then if you do not have the money, and the money is the key part here, I mean, we're all probably familiar with Bill Cosby's arrest, whether he's guilty or innocent. In the interim, he paid bail, he goes home, works on his case. If you cannot afford that, and I think the most important example of this to really give people the picture is Kalief Browder. 16 years old, this was very highly publicized here in New York City, arrested for swiping a backpack. Low bail, but family did not have the money, Rikers Island for the 16-year-old. What they do then is offer you a plea bargain. Here, just say you're guilty and serve a small period of time, but now this felony is on your record. And Kalief Browder said, I didn't do it, I am innocent. And I met many Kalief Browders who said they were innocent, they were going to hold on for their day in court. Well, for this poor young man, he sat there for 3 horrible years waiting for, quote, speedy trial. In that time period, he was thrown into solitary confinement for, I believe, 2 years. He was beaten. There's footage of him being beaten. And he would never, what's most remarkable about him is most people are not superhuman. They'll say, fine, where do I sign just to get the hell out of here? And he wouldn't. He would not. He kept saying, I did not do it, did not swipe the backpack. Ultimately, they gave up. After 3 years, they just dismissed the charges and said, okay, you can go home. But he went home a very, very different person. And a year ago, it was actually last June, Kalief Browder, at the age of 22, committed suicide. And it was because he never recovered from Rikers Island. So this is what it does to people. It's such a tragic story, but he is not an isolated case. The way the system works, very few people will actually ever go to trial. It's kind of dangled as a carrot that you'll never reach because it could be years and years and years before you get to trial. With everything so over-criminalized, there is such a bottleneck to get to trial. The numbers of arrests just outnumber the capacity of courtrooms to try cases, that the solution is to offer everybody a plea bargain. And if you're sitting on Rikers Island, even if you're innocent, sometimes it becomes a matter of survival. You'll say, I'll take it. I did it. And I understood that. People had to forego their futures to survive the moment. But if you had money, you would never have to contend with surviving Rikers Island in your decision, in any legal decisions. Mm-hmm. So it's grossly unfair, not even just a little bit unfair.
Yeah, you know, it was really striking, actually. I mean, very moving. You tell a story of one guy who had a motorcycle accident, and a young kid who ran out from behind a truck and got hit and killed, and this guy was suddenly, this guy did not do anything wrong.
He didn't.
And yet he spent a good deal of his life, and I mean, how long? Years, actually, fighting to say, I will not, because I didn't do anything wrong. I will not take a plea bargain. And eventually it even wore him down. It seems like the whole deal is to just sort of wear you down and just like shuffle you off into a bigger prison. It was very, very, very heavy on that.
I think that is very much how it works. Wear you down, sit there. And in so many cases, the trial, it's not like you get a set date. It could be next year, 2 years, 5 years. And the deal that they offer you is typically a lot less than the time it takes to wait for trial. So in the time that you're sitting on Rikers waiting, if you take the charge, say you did it, you could get, let's say, 1 or 2 years upstate and go home in the time that you're waiting on Rikers for your trial. And for so many people, you do the math, and your principles about what you did or didn't do, your guilt or innocence, take a backseat to surviving. You may have family depending on you to make money. You may have ill, you know, mother, family members you need to get back outside. Or you could be on the wrong side of a gang in there where you're worried for your life. So there are many factors by virtue of your being incarcerated that will push you to say you're guilty that have nothing to do with guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started to work in the women's jail at Rikers. And it was very interesting in terms of some of the same issues faced by women that are faced by men in terms of the questions that we're talking about, the plea bargaining, the, you know, people being there because of the circumstances, their inability to pay bail, and also even just the circumstances of their life. You know, and there was a very moving thing about these young women coming up from south of the border and getting as drug mules and being ending up spending the next 20 years for something that they don't really, it's not even clear to them what they did, but it's just process them through. And I wanted to, you know, there's a comparison there a little bit in terms of the general situation when you were working among women, but then you also got transferred to, when you went back and you didn't get transferred, but when you went back and got a job there, when you ended your student work there, you went back later and got a job there, and you ended up working in the men's jail. You make a point that even as much as you had seen, and it was heartbreaking and just totally, you know, just enraging about what was being done to women in Rikers, that when you went to the men, there was a different intensity of cruelty that you saw there. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it was profoundly different. It was much worse. With men, the charges were a lot more serious. So they were, if they copped out, it was not always to 1 and 2 years. It could be 5, 8, 10, 15 years. For more violent crimes, which lended a sense of desperation to the jail, because now the legal wrangling is very important. Their fates have not yet been carved in stone, so there's a lot of desperation and hope of maybe getting charges reduced, dismissed, really wanting to go to trial to fight charges because the plea bargain offers might not be that good. But what I also was struck by is, for the women, we had a lot of programs. We had groups. We had meditation therapy. There was Narcotics Anonymous. There were parenting groups. There were a lot of ways to support the women for their ultimate return from jail. With the men, there was nothing. It was as though there was a feeling of a big lost cause, and it was a profound sense of sadness. And in terms of mental health treatment, when I worked with the women, the women all wanted initially sleeping pills. A lot of them were coming off drugs, and we would deny it. We would try to get them natural ways to sleep. We wanted to get them off the drugs, break that cycle. With the men, I was so stunned that in my first week, I learned, because I was so used to saying no, that not only did we not give them sleeping pills, it was the opposite. We doled out sleeping pills left and right as if, for these men, it was just a lost cause. Just medicate them, because basically they're all going upstate.
Let me ask you this, Mary, because we have a limited amount of time here right now. We have about 4 more minutes, and there's something I really need to get into, and I was getting so much into all the other things that I don't want to let this go, because one of the things, one of the more really powerful sections of your book is when you talk about solitary confinement in the men's prison and the place called, and what it's called even, the Bing. Tell our listeners about that.
Okay. Well, the Bing is a 500-cell, five-story unit. The formal name is the Central Punitive Segregation Unit, and it's where any man, for males, are brought for any type of jailhouse infraction, from disobeying orders to assault on staff. It's the jail within jail, and it's very dreaded by staff, by inmates, etc. And lo and behold, I wound up being assigned there, and not only assigned, but I became acting chief. And I really didn't know what to expect, but on my first day, learned that virtually everyone, all 500 cells, we had people on psychiatric medications, antipsychotics, sleeping pills, etc., antidepressants. Our saying was, if they had no mental health issues before they entered solitary, they do now. Solitary just breaks down a human being, a human psyche, like nothing I'd ever seen or could have imagined. And what would happen would be, when the meds gave out, we would change them, increase them, do everything we could, but we were frequently called to cell doors where people were banging their heads, cutting themselves, just completely broken people. And it was our job to assess whether or not they might die. That's how grueling this punishment is. And if we thought there was a high risk of death, that was the criteria for taking somebody out. And I just couldn't believe it that what I had come to Rikers there initially to alleviate suffering and help people, I was now kind of, I was a monitor of human suffering. And I was part of a system where I could wriggle a little bit, but you couldn't let a lot of people out. The deal was, this is their punishment. It's up to you, basically, to make sure nobody dies. Mm-hmm. And it was just unbelievable to me, just the level of suffering and the level of cruelty in this punishment, and to discover that it's standard punishment in jails and prisons across the country. Mm-hmm. Although starting to come out, as you probably know, Pope Francis has denounced it. Obama has spoken about it. We're starting to get little chipping away at this, especially with starting to keep juveniles out of solitary. But the whole practice is up close. It's like nothing you could imagine. Just very hard for me to be a part of it, and now very much fighting with groups to abolish it.
Right, exactly. All right, Mary Buser, thank you very much for joining us today. And thanks for just such a powerful book. It's really important that people get this. Sure. All right, take care, Mary. Talk to you again soon, I hope. Okay?
Take
care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Mary Buser. She's the author of Lockdown on Rikers, Shocking Stories of Abuse and Injustice at New York's Notorious Jail. It is the story of her five-year experience in the mental health department at New York City's Rikers Island, and it's a very powerful work. It's published by St. Martin's Press, so get your hands on it, read it, and pass it along to your friends. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back with my interview with Michelle Alexander, so stay tuned.
Too many morning, gotta wake up soon. Oh Lord, I need my breakfast by the light of the moon. Oh Lord, by the light of the moon. If you see my mama, tell her this for me. Oh, I've got a mighty long time. Lord knows I'll never go free. Oh Lord, I'll never be free. Last summer when I got my time,
Angola bound.
Well, my ball, they got 100, I got 99,
Angola bound.
You've been a long time coming, but you're welcome home,
Angola bound.
Angola, Louisiana, get your burdens on,
Angola bound.
Oh, Captain, don't you be so cruel,
Angola bound.
Oh, welcome back. That was Angola Bound from Aaron Neville. A number of years ago, I had the opportunity to interview Michelle Alexander about her book, which had then just come out. And of course, the book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Michelle Alexander is a civil rights lawyer, advocate, and legal scholar, and her book is an incredible critique, an insightful and incisive critique of present-day U.S. society and the systematic oppression of black people that's at its heart. Michelle really shows the nature of the U.S. justice system through the war on drugs in particular. It functions as a new system of racial control. So let's listen to the interview I did with Michelle Alexander. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You argue that the systematic mass incarceration of black people and brown people, but particularly black people over the last 30 years, has created a new racial caste system. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. Well, I believe that within a few decades after the collapse of the old Jim Crow, we as a nation have managed to recreate racial caste in America. Of course, with the election of Barack Obama, it's widely believed we finally triumphed over race. But in some major American cities, the majority of African American men are locked behind bars or labeled felons for life. And once you're labeled a felon, you're trapped. You're trapped in a permanent second-class status in which you may be denied the right to vote, automatically excluded from juries, and legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, food stamps, public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind during the civil rights movement are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon. That's why I say we haven't ended racial caste in America. We've merely redesigned it by targeting African Americans primarily through the war on drugs, and branding them felons, often at young ages before they even are of age to vote, by branding millions of young people of color as felons, often for nonviolent and drug-related offenses, the very crimes that are largely ignored in middle-class white communities, branding them felons, we are recreating a caste system where these people are locked in a permanent second-class status for life.
It's very heavy. You make the argument in your book that the American penal system has emerged as a system of social control unparalleled in world history.
Yes.
And you started to speak to this being a gateway to a much larger and multifaceted system of racial stigmatization and permanent marginalization. But can you give people really a sense? I mean, I know there's the general thing of what it looks like in terms of all of its various aspects and facets, and we'll get into them a little later. But can you give people a sense of the scope of this? Because that's a pretty heavy statement, a system of social control unparalleled in world history.
Yes. Well, consider this. You know, today there are more African Americans in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. You know, there's more African Americans under correctional control today than were enslaved. You know, that's the scope and size of this. You know, I think part of the problem is that when people go to prison, they're out of sight and out of mind. So, you know, it's easy for us to be in denial about just the sheer size, scope, and scale of mass incarceration, because prisons, for the most part, are out of public view. But the reality is that, you know, within a few decades, our prison population has quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing rates of incarceration even in highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. And this explosion in our prison population has not been driven by crime rates. You know, the popular supposedly colorblind justification for the mass incarceration of people of color is crime rates. But as I describe in some detail in my book, crime rates do not even begin to explain the astounding and rapid increase in imprisonment in African American communities. The war on drugs is the primary cause of the prison boom, a war that has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies consistently show that people of color are no more likely than whites to use or sell illegal drugs. Now, more than 30 million people have been arrested since the drug war began, the vast majority of whom are people of color. And while many people assume that the drug war was declared in response to rising drug crime in inner city communities, it's just not true. The war on drugs was declared officially, the current drug war was officially declared by President Ronald Reagan in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. It was a couple years before crack hit the streets in Los Angeles and later spread to inner city communities across America. The drug war was declared in response to racial politics, not drug crime. It was part of the grand strategy of the Republican Party to appeal to poor and working-class white voters through racially coded get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare. Republican Party strategists and pollsters found that they could be highly successful in appealing to white, poor, and working-class folks, particularly in the South, through using, you know, racially coded get-tough appeals on crime and welfare. In fact, H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's White House chief of staff, you know, observed, you know, the whole problem, this is a quote, the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Well, they did. You know, a few years after the drug war was announced and crack hit the streets, the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner-city crack babies, crack mothers, crack whores. You know, the goal was to make inner-city crack abuse and violence a media sensation, bolstering public support for the drug war so that it would be possible to turn what had been a rhetorical war into a literal one. And the plan worked like a charm. For more than a decade, You know, black drug dealers and users would be regulars in newspaper stories and would saturate the evening news. Congress and state legislatures nationwide would devote billions of dollars to the drug war and pass harsh mandatory minimum sentences. Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove that they could be even tougher on crime, tougher on the dark-skinned others who had been, you know, defined in the media as the source of all our social ills. And within an incredibly short period of time, not in response to crime rates, again, crime rates have fluctuated, you know, over the past 30 years and are today, you know, at historical lows, but incarceration rates have consistently soared. They've moved independently of crime rates due to a war that has been declared not against drugs, but against communities defined by race.
Mm-hmm. A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Well, let's talk about this war on drugs and how this is the engine shaping and driving forward this whole new racial caste system. Can you talk, in your book, you go into a lot of detail about the mechanics of this. Can you sort of give us some of the highlights of that, how it actually works?
Yes. Well, one of the biggest myths about the drug war is that it's focused on rooting out drug kingpins or violent offenders. But nothing could be further from the truth. Federal funding flows to those state and local law enforcement agencies that are willing to boost dramatically the volume of their drug arrests, the sheer numbers. You know, the Reagan administration adopted, you know, new rules and new programs that authorized millions of dollars in federal funding to flow to agencies, some of which had initially been reluctant to wage the drug war, feeling that it would be a distraction from more, you know, important crimes like murder, rape, and robbery. And the way in which the Reagan administration persuaded law enforcement agencies to get on board with the drug war was through bribes, through cash, cash grants that were made available to law enforcement agencies that would drastically increase just the sheer volume of drug arrests. And to make matters worse, the Reagan administration managed to change federal drug forfeiture laws so that state and local law enforcement agencies could keep for their own use 80% of the cars, cash, homes seized from drug suspects, thus granting law enforcement a direct monetary interest in the profitability of the drug market. Well, you know, the results have been entirely predictable. You know, people of color are rounded up en masse. Kids are stopped and searched on their way to school. Once they learn to drive a car, their cars are often searched in the hopes of finding drugs, sometimes dismantled. There's sweeps of, you know, public housing projects, schools for drugs. And again, they're not necessarily looking for violent offenders or drug kingpins. They're trying to boost their numbers of drug arrests in these communities. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for possession. Only 1 out of 5 were for sale. You know, most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or even selling activity. In fact, during the 1990s, the period of the most dramatic expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests was for marijuana possession. You know, a drug, you know, now widely believed to be less harmful than alcohol or tobacco and at least as prevalent in middle class white communities as it is in communities of color. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. In fact, in some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders are African American. So, you know, through financial incentives and the Supreme Court granting law enforcement license to stop and search just about anyone, anywhere, so long as they're able to extract consent, you know, the drug war has managed to brand millions of people felons. And, you know, once you're branded, discrimination against you is legal for the rest of your life. People who are released from prison have an extraordinarily difficult time finding jobs. They're forced to check that box on the employment application, no matter if the, you know, minor drug felony they may have committed was 20 years ago, still having to check that box on employment applications. States deny people branded felons professional licenses. Thousands of professional licenses are off limits to felons. Some states you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been branded a felon. Mm.
Let me ask you this, Michelle. First, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to Michelle Alexander, who's the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She's also, as it says on your book cover, you're a civil rights advocate and litigator, and you're also at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State.
Yes.
You know, when you're talking about this, to me, it's really, it's just overwhelming. And again, I sat up and I was rereading your book last night, and I was just, you know, it just pounds you in the head with the, you know, when you go through this and you realize it suddenly jumps out at you. And you tell an interesting story about how this is not something that is really commonly known to a lot of people, including yourself, that you had actually been involved in fighting around civil rights and racism and all this other stuff. But and then you tell a story about seeing an orange poster or something on a telephone pole, and it's talking about the war on drugs as a war on the people or whatever. And you just kind of dismissed it and then came to see, wow, there's really something to this. And I think it'd be interesting to talk about that a little bit, because one thing as you're getting into this, and even including the kind of branding that people go through, but the whole way that this process develops, that virtually everything that people consider to be basic rights and constitutional rights has been gutted and overruled by the Supreme Court. Decisions have been made. It's incredible when you look at what gets, and people don't know this, what gets concentrated up in the war on drugs legally. How many rights and how many things have been redefined in order to facilitate this mass incarceration of people of color?
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court has eviscerated, just shredded, many of the constitutional protections that once protected people from arbitrary and discriminatory police action. Through a series of cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it perfectly legal, you know, for the police to stop people on the street, question them about, you know, potential drug activity or criminal activity, frisk them. So long as, you know, the demand is phrased as a question, it's perfectly legal. So if the police say, will you put your arms up in the air and will you turn and face the wall so we can frisk you, and the person complies, that's interpreted as consent. And so there's no reason for law enforcement to have even reasonable suspicion of criminal activity as long as they, quote unquote, get consent. Now, of course, many people are not brave enough or foolish enough to resist the police when they say, you know, will you put your hands up in the air? May I search your car? People don't understand those to be questions. They understand them to be demands and comply. And often when people do try to resist and refuse consent to search, they face, you know, police brutality. So the U.S. Supreme Court really has paved the way for the roundup of millions of Americans for relatively minor drug offenses. And the Supreme Court has also made it virtually impossible to prove racial bias in the criminal justice system. People always ask me, well, you know, if the system is as biased as you say it is, why don't we hear more about it in the news? Why aren't people filing lawsuits about it? Well, the reason there are not more lawsuits challenging racial bias in the criminal justice system is that the Supreme Court has closed the doors to claims of racial bias at all stages of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. In a series of cases, beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp, the Supreme Court has said that no matter how severe the racial disparities, no matter how overwhelming the statistical evidence, if you can't provide proof that the law enforcement official was acting out of conscious racial bias, you can't even get in the courthouse door, can't even state a claim of discrimination. Now, of course, in the age of colorblindness, where everyone knows better than to say, I stopped him because he was black, I sought the death penalty because he was black, I refused to give him a good plea deal because he was black, because everyone knows better than to say such things, insisting on evidence of conscious racial bias, a smoking gun, guarantees that the routine discrimination that African Americans face in the criminal justice system will never be subject to judicial scrutiny. And in this way, the mass incarceration of African Americans has been immunized from challenge in the legal system, much in the same way that the Supreme Court once protected the institutions of slavery and Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm. Let me again remind listeners that we're talking with Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Now, Michelle, Let's dig into this a little bit more, because you talk about this thing about the colorblindness. And even there, I mean, it's you know, I was really struck by the fact that the things that you bring out about the actual closing down of any ability to address these kinds of things or to challenge discrimination and racial profiling and all this. And in fact, you make a point that the Supreme Court, a very little known decision or a very little known thing, is that the Supreme Court has actually sanctioned, has officially approved, said that the police can actually use race as a factor in determining what they do.
Yes. Well, I call it the dirty little secret about racial profiling, which is that the U.S. Supreme Court has actually authorized law enforcement to use race as a factor in making decisions about whom to stop and search. Now, this is particularly relevant today, you know, now that Arizona has passed a law authorizing law enforcement to demand citizenship papers from anyone, you know, it suspects might be in the country illegally. The claim that this will inevitably lead to racial profiling is absolutely right, because the U.S. Supreme Court has said, specifically in the context of immigration, but it's a decision that applies in drug law enforcement as well, that race can be used as a factor in making decisions about whom to stop and search. So many people hope that the U.S. Supreme Court would reverse that case. It's United States versus Brignone-Ponce. In that case, the court concluded that the police could take a person's Mexican appearance into account when developing reasonable suspicion that a vehicle may contain undocumented immigrants. You know, the court said, quote, "The likelihood that any person of Mexican ancestry is an alien is high enough to make Mexican appearance a relevant factor, you know, in decisions about whom to stop and search." Now, that's, you know, absurd, the idea that anyone who looks Mexican is a reasonable suspect as an illegal immigrant is outrageous. And today, you know, many law enforcement agencies claim that they don't engage in racial profiling, but they do so, they make those claims with a wink and a nod, because they know that they have been authorized by the Supreme Court to use race as a factor, and as long as race isn't the only factor, the only reason for the stop, they can get away with racial profiling.
Well, let's pursue this a little bit more, because one of the contradictions you wrestle with very, very movingly in the entire book, and it's in the title, is that the idea that this is supposedly a colorblind society. And the fact is that you talk about this, and that being raised in such a profoundly racialized and racist system of control and oppression that you lay bare in this, you really get a sense of what the hell is going on here. And then you talk about this in terms of what we've just been talking about, in terms of one of the expressions of how this contradiction plays itself out is the cops and the prosecutors being able to say, we're not dealing with race here, even though they clearly are. They say, we're just using our discretion. And you make two points in that. One is the incredible power that a prosecutor has in the courtroom process and the whole process of actually convicting someone of all this and sending them on their further into the whole system of oppression, this whole new caste system. And then the police. And actually, I had to just sort of jump up when you laid out this point about the discretion, the police using their discretion, or their idea that their discretion just told them to do this, when actually what role they, you know, discretion plays in choosing where they make raids, who they go after, neighborhoods, things like that. So could you talk a little bit about how this they deal with this colorblindness by actually granting this incredible power of discretion to the cops and the prosecutors?
Yes. Well, you know, on their face, drug laws are race neutral, you know. The laws aren't written so that they apply differently to black people or white people or Latinos. On their face, they appear race neutral, but they are enforced in a racially discriminatory manner. And they are able to be forced in a racially discriminatory manner because law enforcement has been granted virtually unbridled discretion in making decisions about who will be stopped and searched, who will be charged for what crimes. There is very little oversight or accountability for law enforcement decisions about who will be stopped, who will be searched, and the same goes for prosecutors. So prosecutors and police have this enormous discretion about whom on the street to view as a suspect, who to go after, who to stop and frisk, who to let walk by. And this enormous discretion inevitably produces racial disparities. Why? Because we all have conscious as well as unconscious biases about who the criminals are. And, you know, as I indicated earlier, these biases and stereotypes, they don't exist in our head purely by accident. They've been created by media campaigns that have been waged by politicians. You know, as I indicated, the fact that our television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug dealers during the crack epidemic isn't an accident. You know, the Reagan administration actually launched a media campaign and hired people whose job it was to publicize inner city, you know, crack users and dealers. And so it's, you know, it's no surprise that, you know, when a survey was done in 1995 asking people, close your eyes for a minute and imagine a drug criminal, you know, 95% of the respondents pictured an African American. Only 5% pictured someone of any other race. So, you know, we now have in our public consciousness an association of crime and race that is deep and profound. And the association between African Americans and drug use and drug sale is profound, even though, you know, people of color are no more likely to use or sell drugs as whites. And the Supreme Court has said as long as law enforcement can identify, you know, some reason besides race for the stop, it's okay for them to use race as one factor. And the absurdity of this logic is, you know, can be evidenced by the fact that the police almost never stop someone solely because of race. You know, a young black kid wearing baggy pants, standing in front of his high school surrounded by a group of similarly dressed black friends may be stopped and searched because the police thinks, you know, he looks like a drug dealer. But clearly race is not the only reason for that conclusion. You know, gender, age, attire, and location are playing a role. The police probably would ignore an 85-year-old black man standing in the same spot surrounded by a group of elderly black women. So there will always be factors that can be cited in addition to race.
Well, you know, I found one of the things that really jumped out at me is when you made this comparison about the police choosing to go into, quote, unquote, the hood, you know, and then as opposed to if you were really going to go after drugs in a sense of like, you know, a lot of drug use on college campuses. Well, they're not bringing SWAT teams in and busting down the walls of dormitories or frat houses to do this kind of thing. And they actually, that discretion is exactly the point you're just talking about, this bias that's actually factored into the whole way that they choose to do things. You know, it's incredibly powerful exposure.
Yes, that's right. Discretion is exercised not only in who will be selected for an investigation or a stop or a search, but also where law enforcement resources will be concentrated in the drug war. And the reality is that, you know, middle-class white communities would never tolerate the drug war tactics that are routine in poor communities of color. Not tolerate it. Not for a moment. Because, you know, drug warriors are not going after the violent offenders, the drug kingpins. They are stopping and searching kids en masse and shipping them off to juvie. Or if they're old enough, branding them as felons and sending them to adult prisons for extremely minor drug offenses. You know, again, you know, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests during the 90s was for simple marijuana possession. This drug war was rounding up folks by the thousands for simple possession of marijuana. This would not be tolerated in upper middle class white communities or on college campuses. In fact, just this week, at Reed College, I don't know if you saw the story. It was actually a story made the New York Times. And Reed College, there had been a couple of heroin overdoses. Now, Reed College is located in Portland, Oregon, mm-hmm. And it's been notorious for open drug use on campus. But there were two heroin overdoses on the campus, and police actually sent a message to the students apologizing for, you know, their loss and warning them that, you know, they were now going to have to enforce drug laws on campus for the first time and that, you know, undercover agents were going to be going to fraternity and sorority parties and that was warning them, you know, stop using marijuana, basically put your drugs away because we're going to have to start enforcing drug laws on your campus. Now imagine, you know, how often do kids in the hood get a kind letter from law enforcement expressing sorrow over, you know, any drug-related losses that, you know, their friends may have experienced, and warning them in advance that, you know, undercover agents were going to be swarming their schools or their neighborhoods. No.
Right. And we're so sorry that we've completely destroyed an entire generation of people. Don't, you know, just we'll make it up to you. You know, that's I have two questions left for you, Michelle, that I really want to try and get to, but we have about 5 minutes to do it in. So I'll ask them real quick. You started to hit on this before, and this point about the invisible punishment aspect of the whole thing and the impact of the prison label, because to me, it really seems that a big part of this is exactly robbing the humanity of people of color, black people in particular.
Yes. You know, I think many people who have themselves never been branded felons or don't have family members who have been just have no idea of all of the forms of legal discrimination that felons face and the extraordinary hurdles that exist to just making it, just surviving once you've been branded a felon. You know, as I mentioned before, you know, employment discrimination is legal against you for the rest of your life, but public housing is also off limits. You know, during the Jim Crow era, that was the era of racially restrictive covenants. But today, housing discrimination against people branded felons is perfectly legal in the private and public housing markets. Public housing is off limits to you for a minimum of 5 years when you're released from prison. And in fact, your relatives risk eviction if they live in public housing and allow you to come stay with them when you're released from prison. So here you are, no job, nowhere to go. Many homeless shelters even screen for criminal convictions. Food stamps are off limits to you for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. Pregnant women, people with HIV or AIDS, ineligible for food stamps for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. What do we expect these folks to do? Well, you know, the great irony is that what we expect of them is to pay often thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. Some states now actually require released prisoners to pay back the cost of their incarceration. And up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. You know, even if you're one of the lucky few who managed to get a job following release from prison, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished to pay back all these fees, fine, court costs, accumulated back child support. You know, what do we expect these folks to do? What does the system seem designed to do? Well, it seems designed to return folks right back to prison, which is what, in fact, happens about 70% of the time. About 70% of released prisoners return within 3 years, and the majority of those who return do so in a matter of months, because the challenges associated with just mere survival, making it in the legal economy and the mainstream society, are so extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So when I say we have a caste system going on today, I mean that this isn't just a matter of people lacking the proper motivation, will, or drive to succeed. No, quite to the contrary. There is a system of rules, laws, and policies in place that serve to lock people in a second-class status for life by law.
And that's one of the things that you even begin your book with, talking about, you know, really at the root of the U.S.-style democracy, this whole creation of a pariah class was really essential to the flourishing of that. To that style of democracy, that system of democracy they have here, to allowing that to flourish, required a pariah class that consisted of black people, slaves, of Native Americans, of women to a certain extent. And it really did, you know, in order for them to deal with this contradiction of supposedly having a colorblind society, even back then where everybody was equal, they just created a pariah class that contained all the people that weren't equal or weren't even human. And that today still seems to be very much at the core of how the society is running.
Absolutely. Every caste system is firmly rooted in the notion that some people lack basic humanity. Many people ask me, well, today most people aren't openly bigoted. Most people aren't openly racist, including police officers. Most of them don't think of themselves as racist, don't want to be racist. How could something akin to a racial caste system exist when most people don't even want to be racist or thought of in that way? And Martin Luther King Jr. warned of precisely this kind of thinking more than 45 years ago. You know, he told audiences again and again before his death that, you know, racial caste systems are rooted in indifference, racial indifference, not in bigotry or you know, overt hostility. You know, it's indifference to the suffering and the plight of people of other races that allows caste systems to emerge and to thrive. He would often point out, you know, even the justices who decided the infamous Dred Scott case, the case that, you know, ruled that the black man has no rights which the white man is bound to respect, he argued those men weren't evil men. By and large, they were decent and, you know, honorable men trying to do right, but they were suffering from a profound spiritual and intellectual blindness. They knew not what they did. And today, you know, I think the same can be said. Just as in the Jim Crow era, many segregationists, many people who voted for segregation were actually kind, very kind to their black shoe shiners, their black maids, genuinely wished them well. They weren't hostile towards them, but nonetheless voted for segregation. Today, many people of goodwill and bad.
We have to wrap it up, Michelle. As much as I really don't want to do this, we have to. And I would just make one comment off of that, though. I have heard it rumored that Hitler did like his dog. Okay? So let's not make any excuses for these fools out there. Michelle, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Well,
and your book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. It's from the New Press, a fascinating book, a really important book for anybody who gives a damn about what's going on in the world. We'll talk to you again soon, Michelle.
Take care.
Bye now.
All right. We've been listening to an interview I did with Michelle Alexander about her book when it first came out. And the book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
An extremely important book and extremely important interview. So I hope everyone was listening closely. And that just about wraps up our show for the week. And before we go, I want you to listen to something I dug up. I was looking around for an appropriate way to finish the show, and I found this quote from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's called Three Strikes. The book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, has shined a bright and much-needed light on the reality of profound injustice at the very core of this country. And this brings me back to a very basic point. This system in this country, in the whole history of its treatment of black people, what has it been? First, slavery. Then, Jim Crow, segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror. And now, the new Jim Crow, police brutality and murder, wholesale criminalization and mass incarceration, and legalized discrimination yet again. That's it for this system. Three strikes and you're out. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guests today, Mary Buser and Michelle Alexander. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor, Alex Brenner, and Matt Kwiklinski, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
We're going to go out now with a song called Let Me See Your ID from Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson.
Everybody uses black and white to try to draw the line between wrong and right. But if you use your eyes to really see, you know we don't see realistically. Because skin that's white is really a pain, so either you can't see or I can't think. Skin that's black is really a frown, but that don't make the world go round. To put a color on skin, to me, is a sin. That's why apartheid must never win. We must put an end to this, my friend, and it should never be allowed to happen again. It's time to wake up and do some good to try to see each other the way we should, because looking at the people, I sometimes find the sunset.